takes delicious delight giving us a hard time.
So between my national job,
I think we're ready whenever you are.
Okay, so let's begin. I'm not sure. the expectation was this close to the holidays, we probably wouldn't have a large crowd, but wanted to do something with MMB in the immediacy of the forecast from last week before some of the information got stale. I assume everybody's had a chance to maybe see the outlines, and I'm not sure. I was actually out of town last week, although was able to listen in on at least the briefing part of the forecast. I've had a chance to read some of the stuff over the weekend, but wanted to have a slightly larger discussion with the individuals. We've got the commissioner and Ms. Kelly, and the new economist, Dr. Stinson's replacement, who we would have had, apparently has had some family problems. So Mr. Pelequin, who's been on the economic staff for, what,
many
10
years?
Many. 12 years? And is as versed with the budget forecast as anybody. Is here as the substitute. We'll get a chance to catch up to I'll have to learn. Dr.
Columbakidis.
Okay, don't mention that to her, but I'll work on that.
It's just between us and you, Mr. Chair, to say Columbo and then add Kiedis.
Okay. I'm sure she'll be with us when we have the next forecast. We'll have a chance to meet her and listen to her. I've been, in going to the two council meetings, was very impressed with how she handled that. Dr. Stinson is obviously, as the cliche goes, a very tough act to follow. But, Mr. Pelequin, appreciate your being here. So, Commissioner, why don't we start with yourself in terms of a review of the forecast. I should also mention, if you look at the agenda, Ms. Weber's here to talk about some of the updates in terms of where we are with the accounting systems, and had a request relative to an interest on the part of several of us, not necessarily at the table, but some of the discussion. Former Finance Commissioner Jay Krodowski is going to be here at some point, and will talk to us about the budget reserve. But Commissioner Showalter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Appreciate being here to talk through and present the November forecast to you today. As you all well know, this is one of two forecasts that we provide. It really is a complete summary of the activity and information that we've had in the past, and then takes that information and projects into the future. It gives you a complete revenue and expenditure view of what's happening. With me today, as the chair mentioned, is State Budget Director Margaret Kelly, who will walk through the expenditure portions of this forecast, and our stellar staff economist, John Pelequin, sitting to my right. Dr. Columbakidis apologizes, and we regretfully she isn't here today, but you will have her here many, many times in the future. The information that you have in front of you is just probably a small snippet of it. I don't know if you have the complete book. As usual, we have taken great pains to go through and write up in detail many of the issues and some of the questions probably that you're going to be asking today in our complete forecast book that's available online. Two more handy and easy-to-access documents. One is the forecast at a glance. It's the one that has a stripe across the top, as well as the slide deck that we're going to be walking through today. Those are the ways that you can access the information, and the information is really good news of what's happening in the state and what's happening, and by extension, what our revenue forecast and projections are going into the future. I should say that as good as that information is and as positive as some of the elements are, it is really still a projection. And we are really at the opening of a two-year period with three more forecasts to go before we really before we work our way through and see what money we've actually collected and get answers to the many questions that we have about what's happening in the national economy, how things are going to be happening with our job trends or our revenue collections in general. But that being said, this forecast anticipates about a $1.086 billion improvement from the last set of figures that you've seen. those figures we're calling in these charts euphemistically the October comparison point. That's shorthand for saying end of session, which you're all very familiar with. It's the end of the estimates that you saw in the appropriation bills from that set this biennial budget, with small changes for the intervening special session, plus the required payback of school shifts using end-of-year balances from fiscal year 13. So those are the two fiscal adjustments that go on to the end-of-session comparison point that you'll see in the charts here today. That $1 billion improvement was more than enough to complete the statutory obligations in 16A. As you well know, we had a number of statutory requirements that if the forecast improves, we would repay. That's the key one that we all knew about and talked about was the school shifts. There were two of them, the aid payment shift, which was completely repaid back with that October or sort of September-October repayment from legislation. And now the property tax recognition shift is completely repaid. Even after all those shifts are repaid and the airport fund is replenished, we still have a balance of $825 million projected by the end of June of 2015. That projection is really based upon a couple of mainline stories here. One is that although the U.S. economy is a little weaker than our last look at it, last February, we are seeing that the state economy is performing quite well and is not completely moving in lockstep with the national economy. Adding on to that is that the revenue collection, it can be variable, and it's not completely tied to changes in GDP, but it's more tied to changes in income, how that income is reported, and the types of income that are maybe changing, and the growth rates of those things. And we'll get into that a little bit as we go along. The other piece of good news is that our expenditures are a little bit lower than expected. Those two things add up to the improvement that we're talking about in this forecast. The story really starts on the first slide. As you see, it's entitled $825 million budget balance projected for 2014 and 15. And this forecast is built off of improvements that you would have seen or probably did see in the monthly revenue updates going on this past spring and this summer, and that resulted in our ability to start paying back the shifts at the end of September. So at the end of fiscal year close, we had more than $600 million that were available to start paying back shifts. That starts in that balance that you see at the top of that chart. The improvements from there in the revenues of $39 billion is $787 million better than previous estimates. The spending at $38.8 billion is lower than previous estimates by $247 million, and that yields that $1.086 billion change. As you can see on this chart, as I said narratively, the school shift buyback, which was initiated in 2010, is then paid back in full. And then the repayment of the airports fund in action in 2008 is paid back, leaving the available balance of $825 million. While these seem like pretty big numbers, I would just also caution you, these, in terms of percentages, aren't particularly big swings. The revenue change is about 2%. The expenditure change is about 0.6%. So it does not take big changes in assumptions, big changes in activity in the state to provide, in this instance, about $1 billion swing in our estimates for this biennium. And, you know, that's, I think, the cautionary tale of being early in the biennium with lots of questions to work through. That is kind of the opening and the big story of this forecast. What I'd like to do now is turn it over to John Pelequin to walk you through the national economy story, the Minnesota economy, and how we got to some of the revenue estimates that we had.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Pelequin, a staff economist, and I'm going to make a presentation based largely on what Dr. Kalambokidis presented a week ago. The U.S. economy has continued to grow at a modest pace in 2013, despite the federal budget cuts known as sequestration and significant uncertainty created by federal policymakers' failure to agree on a fiscal 2014 budget, leading to the 16-day shutdown of much of the U.S. government in October. Many macroeconomic forecasters, including Global Insight, Minnesota's macroeconomic consultant, agree that additional fiscal restraint in the form of sequestered spending and policy uncertainty have taken a toll on business, consumer and business confidence. Lower confidence, in turn, has dampened spending, investment, and hiring in 2013. Consequently, the forecast for U.S. economic growth has slightly weakened since Minnesota's last forecast was presented in February. The Global Insight November baseline forecasts real GDP to accelerate from 1.7% for 2013 to 2.5% in 2014 and 3.1% in 2015. The February baseline forecast called for slightly stronger growth of 1.9% in 2013, followed by 2.8% in 2014 and 3.3% in 2015. And those are all shown on the chart you probably have in front of you. On the horizon for our planning estimates, 2016 and 17, Global Insight increased their growth expectations since February. In 2016, they are now expecting 3.3% real GDP growth, followed by 3.1% in 2017, compared to 2.9% and 2.8% in February. Global Insight's November baseline forecast for 2013 through 2015 is similar to the blue chip consensus, the median of 50 economists and academic forecasts. Despite the slightly weaker outlook since February and short-term challenges, fundamentals for solid growth in the U.S. economy are in place. One of the challenges Global Insight points to is fiscal uncertainty. The uncertainty is in the form of a potential government shutdown and failure to raise the debt limit. It appears that based on the agreement reached by the House and Senate negotiators and passed by the U.S. House last night, and likely to be passed by the Senate, that a budget-induced government shutdown will be averted for the next 2 years. The debt ceiling uncertainty remains. Based on statements from the Treasury, the debt ceiling will need to be raised in March 2014 if the federal government is to continue to meet its financial obligations. Global Insight is hopeful that the bipartisan spirit will continue to prevail and the debt ceiling will be addressed before the last moment. Once short-term challenges, including those federal fiscal uncertainties, are behind us, Global Insight expects growth to accelerate through 2014. The acceleration is expected to be led by an upturn in consumer spending, improved housing and equipment investment, in addition, the easing of federal fiscal drag. Recent positive, albeit preliminary, economic reports support this view. Real U.S. GDP growth in the third quarter is now reported to be 3.6%, and preliminary estimates show an additional 203,000 jobs created in November. And yesterday, the most recent report on retail sales was positive and came in above expectations. November was 0.7%, or 4.7% on a year-over-year basis, and October was revised up from 0.6% up to 0.6% from 0.4%, 4.1% on a year-over-year basis. I should note that the third quarter real GDP number of 3.6% reflects a large increase in inventories and may well imply a slightly smaller growth rate, in the following quarter. Now, even though we talk a lot about the U.S. economic situation, and it certainly does influence Minnesota's economy, growth in state revenues does not march lockstep with U.S. GDP growth. In fact, real GDP can grow moderately while state tax revenues grow fairly well. Before I get to the revenue story, though, let's talk a bit about the link between U.S. growth and revenues, which is the Minnesota economy. The Minnesota economy continues to make solid gains and is some way outperforming U.S. averages. I think there's a chart of non-farm payroll employment.
Bottom of page two.
Bottom of page two. Well, mine doesn't have numbers. Well, non-farm payrolls
Mr.
have increased.
Chairman, could you tell us what chart you're on? It's hard to follow with when we're
Minnesota's
looking at
Minnesota's economy first. Remains strong.
Mm-hmm. Bottom of page two. Okay. Well, you got full page charts. Yeah.
Minnesota's economy continues to make solid gains and in some way outperforming U.S. averages. Non-farm Employment payrolls have increased by an average of 3,400 jobs each month during the first 10 months of 2013, about the same modest pace as the last 2 years, and gains are occurring across every major industry with the exception of manufacturing and federal government employment. That broad-based economic revival has helped Minnesota recover from the recession faster than the nation. As of August 2013, the state has now recovered all of the approximately 150,000 jobs lost during the recession. Nationally, about 82% of the 8 million jobs lost during the recession have come back. The Bureau of Economic Analysis reports the state's real GDP rose 3.5% in 2012, ranking among the six fastest growing state economies during that year. Minnesota's unemployment rate fell to 4.8% in October, the lowest level since the recession began in December 2007, 2.2 percentage points lower than the nation. In addition to a lower unemployment rate, a very encouraging sign for Minnesota's labor market is that first-time claims for jobless benefits have fallen to levels not observed in more than a decade. And leading labor market indicators such as temporary help employment, average hours worked, job vacancies, and the number of unemployed remain strong. Moving to an indicator that directly affects our forecast, preliminary income tax withholding collections during the first 10 months of 2013 suggests that Minnesota's wage and salary income is outperforming previous expectations. In this forecast, MMB economists expect wage income to rise 4.2% in 2013, much stronger than the 2.1% growth expected in February. The growth slows a bit after 2014, but our wage growth is up cumulatively 0.8% over February's forecast. If you want to flip to the next page, I'll talk about revenues. It's a significant gain in forecast revenues. The stronger employment and income growth in 2013 that I've already mentioned has contributed to forecast revenue. Tax revenues for fiscal year 2014-15 are projected to be $37.451 billion, $824 million or 2.2% more than the February estimate adjusted for law changes. The total increase in revenues shown at the bottom there is $787 million when you include non-tax revenues and transfers. Higher income and corporate tax estimates are the source of 95% of the increase in tax revenue. The individual income tax showed the largest dollar amount increase over prior estimates, up $496 million, 2.6%, followed by the corporate income tax, which increased $254 million, or 10.5%. The change in income tax forecast since February is primarily due to an increase in MMB's estimate of tax liability for tax year 2012, the year in which the forecast is based, and increased growth projections for some of the underlying sources of income. We estimate that final 2012 liability will be $8.286 billion, $165 million more than projected in February. For 2012, we raised our assumption about growth rates for particular types of income. Capital gains reported by Minnesota residents in 2012 are now assumed to have grown 94.6%. February's forecast was 82.6%. Assumed growth in Minnesota business income was also raised. Because the outlook for proprietors' income anticipates steady growth, most of the growth in business income is assumed to continue to carry forward in future years. But because we think some of the growth was due to acceleration from later years, it was not all carried forward. Also, farm income, dividends, taxable Social Security was raised in the forecast. Finally, growth projections for the forecast period for other underlying economic variables was raised since February. For example, as I mentioned earlier, withholding collections so far in 2013 suggests that Minnesota's growth in wage and salary income is outperforming previous expectations. This led to an increase in wage and salary growth forecast of 0.8 percentage points cumulatively over the 2013 and 2015 period, but up 2 percentage points in 2013. The increase in projected corporate tax revenues reflects increased expectations for corporate profit growth. Corporate profits were $115.7 million above forecast at the close of fiscal year 2013. Global Insights forecast for corporate profits goes from being pretty flat in February to a 4.5% to 5% per year growth in the November forecast. The change in expected sales tax revenue, there is a change in expected sales tax revenue of $64 million or 0.6%. It was down slightly in 14 and up in 15 due to forecast of stronger growth in taxable sales. To see the bigger picture of this revenue forecast, recall that we ended fiscal year 2013 on June 30th with total revenues of $582 million more than forecast. So starting this forecast, we knew that we had money come in above expectation. $364 million of that was in the income tax. That amount informed our estimate for tax year 2012 income tax liability that I'd mentioned previously. We also knew that that tax year 2012 was likely high because some of the income shifted into 2012 in anticipation of federal tax increases. So we did not assume the entire amount was part of the base on which we built this forecast. Forecast revenue was higher in each fiscal year than was anticipated in February. Following the $582 million we know appeared at the close of fiscal year 2013, we are projecting $346 million over the February forecast for fiscal year 2014 and $441 million over the prior forecast for fiscal year 2015 for a total of $787 million, which you can see in the table. This is the first forecast since the enactment of a new 9.85% bracket in Minnesota's income tax. This change introduces some challenges to forecasting income tax revenues. Income taxes paid through prescribed withholding are relatively predictable. In contrast, much of the tax on non-wage income, such as portfolio income and business income, is paid through estimated tax or through discretionary withholding payments. These payments are more difficult to predict because the income is more variable than straight wages and salaries, and because taxpayers time their payments in response to safe harbor provisions in ways that are not easily foreseen. Because taxpayers affected by the new tax rate report a higher share of income from non-wage sources, a larger share of total income receipts are now being collected through payment of streams that are harder to forecast. And
Mr. Chair, I think that ends the economic section. Do you want to just take questions?
Why don't we listen to Ms. Kelly and, relative to the what's going on the spending side, and then we'll open up for questions and discussion.
Very good.
I'm going to speak to the slide. It's about slide number 7 in your slide deck, little change in spending after forecast buybacks. $38 billion of spending in fiscal years 14-15 is what we're forecasting now, $247 million lower than our previous estimates. Like Commissioner said, it's just 0.6% change, so very small change in spending. There's very little change in K-12 education spending, $10 million lower than our previous estimates, which is a very small change, relatively speaking, to a $16 billion budget. General education aid spending changes are very minor. There was a slight increase in pupil growth in this forecast, which was offset by some corrections made to the general education model from end of legislative session. And those two changes pretty much canceled each other out. Categorical aid spending in the education area is revised downward slightly, which accounts for the $10 million reduction in spending overall in K-12 education. The decrease was in literacy incentive aid due to a drop in third grade reading scores, and that was partially offset by an increase in QCOMP spending with Minneapolis joining that program. Property tax aids and credits is down $70 million in the $3 billion budget area. This is a 2.3% change in spending, so it's a little bit larger than we typically see here, and it's entirely driven by the property tax refund program. Smaller average refund values and lower program participation in 2013 is reducing spending for 2014 through 2017. And what we're finding is that income growth, which John Pelican spoke to in the economy section, income growth is likely outstripping property value growth. In the Health and Human Services budget, our second largest budget area, $11 billion of spending for the current biennium, we're seeing a $117 million decline, lower than previous estimates. It's a very small change for a relatively large budget area again. About a third of the change, or $41 million, is from lower than anticipated spending in the Community Alternatives for Disabled Individuals waiver, or the CADI waiver. This waiver provides in-home services for individuals with disabilities to keep them living in the community as opposed to more costly facility care. In this area, both enrollment changes and average payments in fiscal year 13, so actual payments, were lower than we had anticipated, which is resulting in a lower forecast spending growth in the future in fiscal years 14 through 17. So despite this decline, we're still anticipating a growth in spending into this area between 12 and 16% during the forecast period. About a quarter of the reduction in Health and Human Services, or $26 million, is due to a reduction in the state's share of the Medicare Part D prescription drug payments. This is often referred to as the Medicare clawback. So due to a greater use of generic drugs, our obligation to the federal government for prescription drug programs for folks who are dually eligible on Medicare and Medicaid, our obligation has been reduced in this forecast period, in the current fiscal year, current biennium. The balance of the reduction, $50 million, is from recognizing for the first time in this forecast federal revenues that resulted from a waiver approval. These payments reflected federal share from a rate increase that we applied to governmentally owned hospitals back in, I believe it was 2010, and the waiver was approved in 2011. Moving on to debt service, $28 million lowered spending in this area is more than we usually see in our debt service area, and there are many variables contributing to this, including a reduction in spending due to higher investment earnings and other revenues coming into the fund. So about half of the reduction that you're seeing in the all other category, about $10 million, is due to revised estimates for the Vikings Stadium bond sale. We had been projecting a sale in August, and now we're projecting that sale to occur in January. And we're also assuming an interest-only payment in the current fiscal year as opposed to an interest and principal payment. So after we pay back the remaining property tax recognition shift, $246 million of school shift buybacks, and we repay the airports fund of $15 million, we have a $39 billion budget for the current biennium, which is only a $13 million change over our previous estimates of spending. I'm going to turn it back to you.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I will conclude then the presentation on the next chart with just a couple more pieces of information to pull it all together again. The next one is titled Positive Forecasts of Restored Reserves and Repaid Accounting Shifts. As the State Budget Director mentioned, we have made improvements lower than anticipated spending. As Staff Economist John Pelican said, we have higher than expected revenues. Those combine to trigger existing statute that has worked for us in a very profound way for the last couple of years. Looking back at November 2011, it started with a forecast improvement that allowed us to restore the cash flow reserve. There was still some money in the cash flow reserve at that point, but it got us back up to the $350 million level, and then also started adding money back into the budget reserve. It continued on with the subsequent forecasts so that each time we have the conditions where our forecasts are improving, the first call on that money is to basically improve and restore our state's balance sheet. Over the course of those 2 years, a total of $3.7 billion have been dedicated to doing just that, moving us from a place where we had been managing cash, and one of our primary fiscal management challenges was literally how to pay the bills in the next couple of months, to a position where we have restored the statutory level of reserves and repaid the schools and are looking at the medium to longer term horizon as for fiscal planning. That is a substantial accomplishment on behalf of the state, and really I think is one of those reasons that we go to the rating agencies and say we have a strong financial management culture here, that this statute has worked in the past and it continues to work and puts us back in a place of recovering from the recession quickly and in, I think, a very determined fashion. The 2016 and 17 planning estimates are on the next slide and show that those have also improved. As Mr. Pelequin suggested, this forecast starts with a better collections in the current tax year and the past tax year. That improved some of the data and the estimates for our anticipated revenues in 2014 and 15. That carries on through into 2016 and 17. So what you see here is an estimated change of about $1.5 billion in projected revenues over this period of time. Spending is much closer. That structural balance of about $2.2 billion is kind of an apples and oranges comparison. As we always footnote and as required by statute, that's not including any inflation on the spending side. So, you know, on a very simple basis, if you were to include a discretionary inflation estimate, that would be about $1.2 billion of that $2.2 billion. But either way you look at it, we're in a much better and a much more sustainable position than we were staring at just a year or two ago, for no doubt. The issues of where to go from here are many. I'm sure they'll come up in the questions, but you know, certainly this has been a good economic forecast, and it's really due to the hard work of Minnesotans, creating jobs, getting jobs, being creative and innovating, and continuing to show that Minnesota's economic performance outstrips those of other states. Our revenues have followed suit, and we're happy to bring this forecast to you.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner. Let me just, Mr. Pelequin, a few questions. First of all, I had thought, and correct me if I'm mistaken, that the third quarter results from this year were somewhat more positive than anticipated in terms of GDP. Am I correct or mistaken in
Mr.
that?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Okay, so is that still reflected in Global Insights? Diminishment of GDP for 2013, or was that information not available for Global Insight?
I believe that is included. That is included in their forecast. In other words, I think the information was available. They just released another forecast yesterday, and they raised the GDP growth rate for the current year by a tenth of a percent, and I think they raised 2015 by a tenth of a percent, but it did not change dramatically.
Okay. And certainly one of the lessons imparted by Dr. Stinson over the years was don't get too excited by slight variances in GDP growth or diminishment. But I think I also read that, and this would fall into the category of don't get too excited, I assume, in terms of the long-range economic forecast. But I think I read that the Thanksgiving sales were greater than anticipated. Now, obviously, that don't know where Christmas sales go. But if, in fact, the end of the year sales receipts nationally are somewhat stronger than anticipated, does that suggest something on a one-time basis or a stronger retail market than we've been seeing?
Mr. Chair,
would it continue into sales in February, March, April, May, and so on?
Mr. Chairman, it would not necessarily continue. And I think it's always hard to measure the Christmas sales, especially with the way the Thanksgiving holiday fell. But I should say the most recent retail sales report was quite positive. But And as I had said earlier, Global Insights expecting an increase in consumer spending, but I don't think that Christmas sales are determinative.
Okay. And then just kind of these are some disparate questions, but looking at the projected GDP over the next several years where 16 and 17 has a projected larger GDP growth than what had been projected with the previous forecast. I don't know if it's – I think in the past I've quoted people from the council. Obviously, the council meetings are not public hearings as such. But I know that Mr. Laufenberg, I think, had voiced some concern that we've had a fairly lengthy period of economic expansion and we're overdue for a recession. And maybe I'm paraphrasing what he said, but I think. But I believe he sounded a little bit more of a pessimistic note. And correct me if I misunderstood him. But historically, we've been in a period of not huge growth, but limited growth. And I think, as I understand it, we've been considered out of the recession for, what, 2 or 3 years?
Mr. Chairman, since I think the second or third quarter of 2009, the economy's been recovering and then started expanding when it went past its pre-recession peak.
Okay. So normally, in terms of economic cycles, when do we hit another recession, and how does that affect these numbers and where we might be in terms of the budget?
Mr. Chairman, I think your characterization of what Member Laufenberg said is accurate. I think he said he thought we were that he thought it likely a recession in the 16-17 period. But economists are not very good at forecasting recessions. But the longest expansions I think we've seen have been on the order of about 10 years. During the 60s, I think we had one that was almost 10 years, and I think in the 90s we had one that was almost 10 years, and I think in the 80s it was about 9 years.
What I found concerning about Mr. Laufenberg's comments were, if I'm not mistaken, I think he's had some national awards for forecasting ability. So, I don't know if other members have had the chance to attend these meetings, which are in terms of an education, are just of huge value, where a few of us are invited. But the economists who sit around the table are a mixture politically, and I think it would be a fair statement that Mr. Laufenberg politically is probably more conservative than some of the other members of the council. But I find his comments striking based on what I think is his forecasting reputation and ability. So when he suggests – it's not that I'm, you know, selling stock as we speak, but when I hear him talk about the possibility of a recession, I guess that gave me a little bit of pause. And I don't think anybody else around the table talked about it the way he did. But I just wonder if that's the case, is there a chance we'd see some different 16 and 17 GDP projections at some point down the road?
Mr. Chairman, as I said, economists haven't done a good job of forecasting recessions, so they almost never forecast one until it's almost upon us or is upon us. I don't think the last recession was forecasted until a quarter after it had started.
Yeah. I mean, Mr. Chair, I would add, I think your characterization is right, and it is one of those the conversation between the economists is always a valuable check on the Global Insights projections and our own staff economists' interpretation of that, because it gives us some regional information, gives us some also just sort of expertise from the private sector and other organizations that helps make this richer. The conclusion is usually there's risks out there. and we have concerns. And that's a very fair and valid thing, because they've seen these cycles, and you never quite know when they're going to hit. So we always, I think, caution, and I think the economists caution even harder than we caution, that the planning estimates are just that. They're planning estimates. They're benchmarks going forward, but should not be taken literally as a projection of the economy going into 16 and 17.
Okay. And lastly, Mr. Pelequin, one of the things that's always that's been noted by Global Insight, and you alluded to it, when they offer their projections in terms of what their baseline projection is and what would be the optimistic and what is the pessimistic, which my sense is usually the variance is 20% on either side with 60% in the middle, you know, give or take, that in the last couple of go-arounds, their downside has usually made a reference to what's going on in Washington and the combination of budget uncertainty, debt ceiling uncertainty. And I realize you can't speak for Global Insight, obviously. I'm not asking you to do that. But with the budget agreement this week in Washington, if that were to foretell maybe less brinksmanship in terms of the federal budget process, you know, would we see then potentially, let's say this continues, if we saw the March forecast, would we possibly see from Global Insight less of a concern in terms of a downside to a projection?
Mr. Chairman, what you say does make sense, and I think in Global Insight's forecast flash yesterday, they made reference to the budget deal and implied that that would, if that continued, especially with regard to the debt ceiling, that that would, the outlook would be better. Less uncertainty, the better the outlook, in Global Insight's opinion.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, there's a brief discussion of some of those issues on pages 14 and 15 of the full document. And I think the one thing that I think you get as policymakers, and I think Congress gets too, but is that there's real impact of the uncertainty over those deals. And that the narrative in our forecast just discusses a little bit about that and how that spreads into the economy and some of the drag that has been present in the U.S. economy because of that fiscal uncertainty. Clearing that up would certainly be a good thing.
Okay. Other questions for Sir Goodwin?
Thank you. Mr. Kelly, Director Kelly, you said something about the caddy waivers. The spending is down in that area, and I don't know if you can answer this question, but I've heard a lot of complaints from different social service agencies and so forth that say that there seems to be long waiting lists and it's taken a whole lot longer to get caddy waivers than it used to. And so I'm wondering what's changed. If the money is there but it's not being spent, then why are people waiting so long to get waivers? It sounds like being turned down more often. Is there some effort to withhold or save money in that area, or have the rules around obtaining those waivers changed, or what's happened?
Mr. Chair, Senator Goodwin, that's a really good question, and I'm not sure I can answer that, but I'd be happy to ask someone from DHS to follow up with you.
That would be great.
The forecast is based on actual experience and then trending that forward, and so there is part of it is enrollment and part of it is reduced average spend per individual. There is still projected to be significant enrollment growth in the period, so it's just a slight downward adjustment of the growth.
Okay.
But as to the details about what is driving that actual experience, I'd have to DHS follow up with you.
Thank you.
Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do have several questions, so I'd like to just go through each of them. The first question is with regard to the decrease in our unemployment figures. Do we have any knowledge right now about those who have come off the system because they've been, you know, the chronically unemployed, that particular category, as well as our students just entering the workforce? You know, they don't apply for unemployment insurance. So do we have any statistics with regard to those, that rate of employment on both those ends?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I'm not an expert on unemployment, but the state does not have a measure for the broadest. I don't believe the state has. I think it's called U6 measure of unemployment that takes into account the discouraged workers. So I don't think that I don't think we have that information. I should also say I think that state unemployment rates are they're measured on the basis of a small sample, and so it's hard to measure the state unemployment rate, so you measure it over long periods of time, although Minnesota's unemployment rate over long periods of time has been less than the U.S., and it continues to be. So I think we can be confident it's less, but we have less information on the broader measure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I asked both those, too, because I think those are categories of workers that we have to pay a particular focus on. In terms of the long-term unemployed, it's those who are a little bit older and lost their jobs in the recession. And from what I hear from the people in my community, a lot of them have just given up because they don't feel welcome back in the job market. And so I think that's a group that can be a liability for our state as the baby boomers are aging and needing services. And then I do hear about the trouble that our students are having in finding those first jobs. With regard to the increase in income tax revenue, when the forecast was first done, Commissioner, was the did you factor in the rate that was moving through the legislature, the 9.8 or whatever? Do you assume in previous forecasts that those things are going to become law, or is that part of why it's so dramatic?
Mr. Chair, Senator, the changes in the forecast is always based on current law. So whatever the current law is at the point of the release of the February forecast is the basis for that forecast. So, you know, there have been times in the past where the legislature was moving a bill forward in January or early February, and it was quick conversations just to make sure we understood what the timing was likely to be so we could make sure we captured that. Obviously, the fourth tier was not at that point in time part of current law and was part of the end of session numbers. This is our opportunity to really sort of refresh that trend of what's going on. The revenue anticipated from any tax law changes, any spending changes last session, were already rolled into that end of session number. So this is really more an estimate of going forward of how we expect that adjusted figure to trend forward.
Good, thank you. And then Ms. Kelly, with regard to the HHS number, in previous forecasts where we have seen a decline in spending, there's been conversation around less people taking up the opportunity with the expanded Medicaid program, and you haven't mentioned that. Is that still a factor, or have we now just assumed we're getting who we're going to get, and so we've adjusted our expectations? Did we ever see the surge in expansion that we had once hoped for?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, that's a really good question. We are assuming in this forecast what we have assumed in the past about enrollment growth due to the Affordable Care Act and the individual mandate in particular. As the Affordable Care Act is implemented and as we start to see actual enrollment numbers based on MNsure being up to speed come January and February, we will start to reflect those actual numbers in our forecast. So we will be making revisions based on what we see happen probably a little bit in February, but probably more in November of next year.
Mr. Chair, so with regard to those people that we thought were going to take advantage of the expansion, and then we saw those, what happened to them? Do we know that? You know, they were on Minnesota Care, then we thought they were going to go with that, and they didn't.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, so we had made some assumptions about the number of people who would enroll in Medicaid due to the early expansion, and in previous forecasts, we had ratcheted that down, and so not as many people had enrolled as we had thought, but we are still holding with the current assumptions that are a little bit lower, and once we have better data about what is continuing to happen, given the continued rollout of the Affordable Care Act, we'll make some changes in the assumptions.
Thank you. And then final question. With the renewed optimistic GDP estimates, do we expect then a change taking place with interest rates that the feds might enact that would then affect the state's overall financial picture? I think that's something that individuals are worried about and trying to plan their own financial planning based on you know, what we think is going to happen around the rates.
Mr. Chair, Senator, great question, and that's something that the economists and the council have discussed extensively. There's some discussion that in the forecast book as well, and it's that the monetary policy and how that will start to be reeled back in as the national economy starts to strengthen. It is one of the uncertainties that we talked about earlier, and the assumption in the forecast is that there will be gradual reversal of some of the Fed policies and a slight increase in the interest rate environment starting sometime in the next year or so. But that is, you know, going to be played by ear and one of those things that we'll be watching closely.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner, wouldn't you think that if, you know, that does go higher at a faster rate than what would be expected, that that could, you know, be a volatile thing in our own financial planning?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator, in fact, you know, the chair talked about one of the council members suggesting how a recession could occur, and inflation is one of those factors that if fiscal policy goes awry, inflation could come, and that would quickly staunch off any growth.
Thank you.
Senator Stump.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have two questions. When you were mentioning about the changes in the spending, I was under the assumption that the Minneapolis School District was in already participating in the QCOMP program. And maybe, I don't know if there's anyone from the Minneapolis School District, or I thought that that was, unless the only part of the district was participating in QCOMP, I'm not sure. Does someone have the answer to that? And then I have another question, too.
Well, you can do Dibble. Well,
Senator Dibble, did you want to speak for the Minneapolis School District?
Well, Chair, Senator Bono probably knows in finer grain detail, but it's a confusing, somewhat tortured story. But the upshot is they're fully participating now, and the teachers are being paid. That was part of the problem, that they'd come in or partially come in, people weren't being paid for their participation.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Stump, it was part of the contract negotiations that were pretty contested during the last contract negotiation, and they did all then decide to go in that contract negotiation.
Okay. So that was a change.
Senator Stump.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The other question is relates to revenues. And sometimes we think about the loss of revenues from internet sales. But there's if we would turn that around, when we purchase something, a resident from Minnesota purchases something, they have an obligation to pay the use tax, correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator, that's correct.
So, in a sense, people who buy things and do not pay the sales tax from over the internet, we end up losing revenue to the state.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, that's correct, although I think there's a de minimis amount of in excess of $700, whatever would generate an annual tax of $50. So if you bought $700 or less over the internet from somebody that wasn't collecting the tax, in theory you wouldn't have a liability. But if you spend more than that on those purchases, you would.
Okay.
Use tax.
Mr. Chairman, the question is why in the revenue forecast do we not see some evidence of that? Either as a loss of revenue or as a potential gain of revenue.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, there is an estimate in the sales tax forecast. That's taken into account. The consumption spending is reduced by the presumed internet sales. It's hard to measure the revenue loss from them, but there is an estimate in there.
Okay. So, Mr. Chairman, the last point is that would it be possible to get the information over, let's say, the last period of years as to how that might be tracking?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, the Department of Revenue puts out something called the Tax Expenditure Study, and I think that would show what the revenue loss is. I'm not 100% certain, but I think it would.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah. Other, Mr. Pelequin, I'm sorry, Senator Weaver.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, how might the forecast impact our AA rating?
Mr. Chair, Senator, as everyone knows, we're one step below AAA. We want to be at AAA. We think we are AAA, but nobody else thinks so. So how this will affect it is positively. I mean, it's good news. We will be bringing that to the rating agencies and try to convince them that we are worthy of the highest rating available, getting us sort of more favored responses from our bond sales. That said, it's a slow climb back. And I would not forecast a change in the ratings, except that we are going to continue to point out, I think, the really solid fiscal performance of the state, the strong economy that we have, and see when the rating agencies see a sustained performance that they would agree that we should be a AAA again.
Okay, and Mr. Pelequin, I want to ask a question which might be difficult to answer, but you indicated that our unemployment rate is at 4.8, more than 2% below where the national unemployment is. Do you happen to know or recollect when the economy was at its peak, say, in 99, 2000, where was Minnesota's unemployment then?
Mr. Chairman, I may be able to look that up and tell you in a couple minutes.
Okay, well, if you have it, I have a let me – if you need a minute to look it up. Commissioner Showalter, let me ask about something else. Yeah. For the last number of budget forecasts, there's been a section in the forecast, and you alluded to it, relative to inflation being placed in the budget forecast. And I think it was Mr. Anton who always pushed to do that. So now in this budget forecast document, we have the Stinson section relative to the budget reserve. Mm-hmm. So the budget section and obviously what was recommended by all of the economists was an increase in the state's budget reserve. Any sense on the part of the agency if you have a position or any feelings about it? And I don't know if that fits into Senator Wieger's question about the bond rating.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members, we are really familiar with the forecast and the forecast process. And as such, we are very aware of the risks and uncertainties and assumptions that are built into it. And so historically, our agency, our representatives, our economists have pointed out that there's risk, so that that somebody hearing the number that there's $825 million projected balance thinks, I've got $825 million to spend, doesn't necessarily get the full flavor of all of the questions that we still are working through, but we're giving you a point estimate of where we think we're going to come out. It's a long wind-up to say that, you know, we recommend and have given you studies and information on the adequacy of our reserves or the inadequacy of our reserves and how much risk you're really buying for the roughly $1 billion of cash flow and budget reserve that are in place. The amount of insurance that you have has been shrinking over time because the state budget gets bigger and the volatility of some of our revenue sources and our ability to predict and forecast those revenue sources has become more cloudy. So you know, that's a long way of saying we would prefer smoother, steadier approaches, and that's why we emphasize the limitations of our long-term projections, that the forecast for 4 years gets more and more volatile as you go out, and understanding that there's some discrepancies between those numbers should limit your belief that there's a $2.2 billion structural balance, but in fact there's a risk of recession, and that there's certainly a risk of inflation on the spending side. Similarly, that the reserves may not be adequate over the long term, and that as a policy matter, we should have a conversation of whether those should be increased, whether now or sometime in the future, because we would think that the state would be better served to handle some of that risk that way as well. There's other tools that are available, whether it's putting cash in the bonding bill, whether it is leaving money on the bottom line. There's all kinds of different approaches, but the Finance Committee is our partner in managing that risk. And we certainly are very attuned to it and hope you are too.
So right now we're at the statutory requirement of, what, 661? Is that the figure?
Yes. Mr. Chair, I think the limit is 653, and then we keep on having a statutory trigger that puts some money from the assigned risk plan into the budgetary budget reserve.
Was there any recommendation from the council? We've got the budget book, the forecast book in front of us, which doesn't specify a figure. Was there any discussion within the council as to what would be appropriate or recommended?
Mr. Chair, yes, there was. And as I stated in front of the council, I didn't think it was necessarily appropriate for the council to make those fiscal determinations and say this is the number, because in some ways this is a matter of choice of how much insurance do you want? How much risk are you willing to take to the tax levels or to the spending levels of the state and risk that they need to be abruptly changed? That's really a matter for the governor and for legislators to determine. We have provided you some information, though. MMB submits a report periodically, and that last one suggested that about $1.7 billion reserve account would be necessary to adequately manage the cyclical risk. There was about seven years ago a State Budget Trends Commission that did a lot of analytical work looking at the risk factors and also came up with some different scenarios, again, saying how much risk do you want to try to manage. So there are numbers out there. I'm not saying any of those are the number, but they certainly help you balance that risk and reserve question.
Okay, thank you. Further questions for Mr. Pelican? Did you have
Mr. Chairman, in 1999, as far back as my information in front of me goes, the state unemployment rate was 2.8%, contrasted to the U.S. unemployment rate of 4.2% in 1999. And I think that was probably the low point of, the recent decades in terms of state unemployment rate.
So if the Minnesota economy were to continue, I think the projection for national unemployment in the next year might be pushing 6%. If that number is correct, and if we were to follow suit, we might be starting to push where we've been in terms of an all-time low relative to unemployment in Minnesota, or coming close to that. If you were to see the same kind of downward trend on a comparable basis,
Mr. Chairman, I'd be surprised if we hit the all-time low again. But there's probably structural factors that may make that more difficult. But that's more speculative.
Okay, thank you. Further questions? Okay, Serenino.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Comment and a question. Going back to your line of questioning regarding budget reserves, et cetera, it is my opinion, I think many others would probably back this up, that our budget reserve, as our general fund has grown, has become notoriously small. We probably would, the state would be well served if we're looking at an $800 to $900 million projected surplus to dedicate all of that money into the budget reserve rather than spending it on other one-time expenditures or ongoing expenditures. At least if we did that, we would put ourselves into that range of about a 5% budget reserve, which is kind of a guideline that many use. I say that just food for thought as we go forward into the upcoming session. And then a question, Commissioner Showalter, I would be completely remiss if I didn't ask about stadium funding. The my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, is that we will be needing to dip into. We had a one-time cigarette tax, tobacco tax, to burnish the reserves, and that we're going to be needing to dip into those reserves to make payments on the bonds as they come due in the future. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Mr. Chair. Senator, the stadium, I just quick commercial for all of the other questions that are in this. I should note that the consolidated statement for other funds is also due, probably will be out by the first of the year. So there's information on other funds that's coming. The stadium financing is one of those things that's in progress right now. What's in the forecast is an assumption of including a dramatically lower estimate for e-pull tabs and gambling revenues, charitable gambling. Using the corporate tax that was included last year as a backstop as a sort of supplementary or a replacement revenue source. And, yes, the floor stocks tax is included in that calculation of the reserve and is assumed to be used early on as part of the debt service for those bonds. The bond assumptions that we have in here are still fairly simple, but they're getting closer to what's probably going to happen. And that means that we didn't issue the bonds earlier as we had previously anticipated. We're likely to do those bonds in sometime around January.
Certainly. And, Commissioner, if we do indeed need to utilize reserves in whole or in part, is there a plan or a strategy to refill those?
Mr. Chair, Senator, absolutely. And right now, you know, the assumptions even within this forecast show that on a year-by-year basis, while there's some years that are good, some years that are less good in the revenue estimates, the bottom line is that the revenues, even from these fairly conservative estimates, more than pay off those bonds, more than pay off the operating costs of the stadium, and more than pay off the obligations for the city of Minneapolis after they've repaid us. So those are multiple pieces that are all going on in that reserve calculation. But, yes, we still look good.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I just had a quick question about the repayments to the airport fund.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone was super happy about the payment of the school shift, and I actually did a press release on the repayment to the airport fund. I was really happy about that because I was really happy when – or really unhappy when that money was taken out. We actually had – hearings and why did this happen and how did this happen and et cetera, and how are we going to fix it. Just so I understand the kind of the order of magnitude of this $15 million, do we know roughly how much is kind of carried in the airport fund? And Mr. Peterson is here. Maybe he knows. Kind of how big is that fund, generally speaking?
Mr. Chair, Senator, you've stumped us.
No, actually, I haven't.
Ms. Kelly.
I take
Ms.
it back.
Kelly.
It would look like there's about, prior to the addition of the $15 million, there was $4 million at the close of our estimate for fiscal year 14.
Right. So, wow. Mr. Chair, it's a big deal.
Okay.
And it really, it put a real damper on our ability to do for airports around the state what we needed to do. And it happened under the cover of darkness inside one particular office in this building with no forewarning or knowledge by anyone. So I'm really happy that we're doing this.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you for your testimony. I'm going to go out of order to follow up on our reserve discussion. We have somebody scheduled to speak to us. Then we want to have a few minutes with Ms. Weber on the budget system, obviously. But Mr. Kudrowski, the agenda indicates Mr. Kudrowski is currently a fellow with the Humphrey School. Mr. Kudrowski was a former finance commissioner a number of years ago, I think, for with Governor Perpich, and more recently was one of the co-chairs of the Budget Trends Commission, if I'm not mistaken, along with former Commissioner Kevin Goodnow, I think, was the other co-chair. And you had a couple of thoughts following up on Commissioner Showalter's comments relative to the budget reserve.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Jay Kudrowski. I'm a senior fellow and faculty director of the Public and Nonprofit Leadership Center at the Humphrey School of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota. My comments today are my own and do not reflect the University of Minnesota or the UCARE organization for which I serve as a board member. I appear today, as Chairman Cohen said, as a former Minnesota Commissioner of Finance and co-chair of the Minnesota Budget Trend Study Commission, to remind you that Budget Trend Study Commission was created by the legislature. It included five appointees of Governor Pawlenty, five appointees of the Senate, and five appointees of the House. I was a Senate appointee to that group, and in the first meeting, I unfortunately was selected to be the co-chair along with former Commissioner Kevin Goodnow, who was a governor's appointee. What I'd like to do is point out some of the key recommendations of the report to you that was completed in 2009. You should have a handout in front of you that says Minnesota Budget Trends Study Commission Recommendations, 2009. If you would look first at recommendation number three, recommendation number three would require that inflation be included for expenditures in the state economic forecast, as is done in other states, as is done in the federal government, as is done in well-managed public, nonprofit, and private organizations with which I am familiar. As an example, nearly $1.2 billion inflation dollars have been omitted from the recent forecast for 2015-16, distorting the size of the surplus in that out biennium. The use of inflation on the revenue side and not on the expenditure side, frankly, must end. You need to have a factual forecast, not one that's lopsided. Recommendation eight would require a structurally balanced budget for the current and following biennium. So as you complete revisions to the 2014-15 biennial budget this session, you need to review the impact the revisions are going to have on the 2016 and 2017 biennium to ensure that there's a surplus at the end of that biennium. So you need, in a sense, a scorecard as you're making your decisions to make sure you're not doing something. And the best example is doing something for the last half of the last year of the current biennium, which then has an impact of four times in the following biennium, which could put you into deficit. So that's recommendation number eight. Recommendation number 15 relates to the budget reserve and suggests that the budget reserve be increased to $2.1 billion, or 5% of the biennial revenues. I think Commissioner Showalter is part of the administration and isn't at liberty to tell you what he might really think of what needs to be done as it relates to the budget reserve. The 5% figure was derived from an analysis that indicated a reserve of that size would cover 19 of 20 possible forecast outcomes. And let me pause there and just reflect on this, because I was Commissioner of Finance after the 81-82 recession, and we had a slowdown in 85, and I can remember Governor Perpich yelling at me that he didn't want to be governor if we had to have another downturn in the economy, as if I could do something about it. That's when he started counting cranes to dismiss the state forecast. At that time, we analyzed the situation and found that the average variance in state forecasts is plus or minus 5%. That's plus or minus $2 billion or a $4 billion error range around the forecast. The work that was done by the Budget Trend Study Commission confirmed that and also said that in 19 of 20 cases, that will be the error range. But in 1 out of 20 cases, it will exceed that or have a surplus greater than that. And that 1 out of 20, in fact, was the 2008 recession. So that recession, called the Great Recession, was the exception to the rule, and it was the 1 out of 20 case. But that means that 19 of 20 cases, if you have a $2 billion reserve, you will be able to live through a biennium and not have to come back into session and make difficult decisions after you've already adopted a budget. Now, I know how difficult it would be for you to recommend and, in fact, enact a $2 billion reserve. So I would recommend to you to up the reserve, take some of the $825 million and up the reserve to $1 billion as a good faith down payment for building the budget reserve, and then include in the final legislation, financial legislation of the session, that any additional dollars coming in as a result of reforecast produce additional dollars, that those additional dollars simply go into the budget reserve to build that budget reserve up to the level of the $2 billion. And it is correct that as the budget grows, you're going to need more than $2 billion. But I can sit here today and share with you how much the state forecast is like a roller coaster. There are huge ups and downs. I've been part of three different commissions that have looked at this question, and all three have come up with the same conclusion, and that's that you need a larger budget reserve. It's just that simple. And right now, it feels like we're at the near the top of the roller coaster, and what you can't see is that big downside on the other side of the peak of the roller coaster. But that downside will come, and it could come in the next 6 months. We could have a disruption in the national or in the international economy. Greece may, in fact, find that it can't repay its bonds. The European banks have tremendous difficulties with their finances. We could find that China is not, in fact, producing as well as they say they are. There's a lot of concern about the data coming out of China's and China's economy. Or we could have a scare of inflation in the United States, or the Federal Reserve next week could, in fact, decide to reduce the purchases they're making currently of bonds in the marketplace. Any one of those factors could trigger a dramatic change in the forecast that you just reviewed. So with that, Mr. Chairman, hopefully I've been responsive to your question, and I'd be happy to take questions from the committee.
Questions are Mr. Stump.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, in fact, we actually did pay back over $2 billion to our reserve, and that was the use or borrowing that we do amongst different funds within the state. So I think the different options are I think Minnesota has a pretty healthy set of options to continue to operate. I think it's actually better than if we just had a huge reserve that's sitting there, because when the economy starts to go into a recession or slows down, I think it's probably healthier for all of the state to share in that slowdown. So the time that I've been here, we've borrowed, I think, three times from our different local governments, from our schools, and we've paid them back each time. Now, in 2004, when we put in place the automatic payback, I think that was a very healthy way of doing it, because we could not spend money automatically on other programs until our schools got paid back, unless the legislature so chose to. But I think if we had $2 billion, and I don't want to argue against a good, healthy reserve, but I think that having a big reserve alone is not adequate, because that's going to be tempting for the legislature, and I've seen this happen time and time and time again. It's money that could go into tax relief or tax cuts. It's money that could be spent on programs, other types of programs. So with the borrowing that we do, it's a signal to say, to programs, whether it's education or whether it's health and human services or whether it's some other program, listen, we have to start slowing down the spending, and everybody's going to participate in it, either by reduced spending or some additional tax increases to, you know, kind of support that spending. So I'm creating a rationale that I believe is fairly healthy in the state right now. And I'm not arguing against a larger reserve, but I'm saying that alone is not as good, I think, as having a mix of things.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Stumpf, I think you and I can disagree about that. I think the school districts who had to borrow to meet their cash flow needs might disagree with you as well. I think the state employees that didn't get salary increases for 5 years might disagree with you that a larger budget reserve would prevent some of those things from occurring. There are consequences of the shifts, of the cuts, of the changes that have to be made when the state forecast is wrong. Other states have had the fortitude to create larger budget reserves. There are states that have 5% of their general fund operations in reserve. Those states are better managed. It would go a long ways to helping the state with the credit rating to have a budget reserve of $1 billion or a couple billion dollars. While the state has found a way, it's been a very, what I would consider, torturous way of resolving the difficulties that the state has had.
And Mr. Kudrowski, you raised the question of the rating agencies. I think it was Senator Wieger who asked that question. I think when the rating agencies, and correct me if I'm wrong, downgraded our rating, it was based upon, among other things, the amount of shifts and borrowing we were doing.
That is correct, to my understanding, Mr. Chairman.
And Mr. Kudrowski, I don't know that we have the information in front of us. You mentioned other states that use a 5% figure. Do you know offhand what states do that?
Mr. Chairman, I don't, and I didn't say that other states use the 5%. I said other states have in excess of 5% in budget reserve.
Okay.
There is no standard. It really depends on your circumstances and your tax base, and the Department of Finance, or now Minnesota Management and Budget, actually did a calculation to determine that the 5% gives you a 95% confidence level that the forecast will be within that $2 billion range over an entire biennium.
Other questions for Mr. Kudrowski? Let me just – I appreciate – I'm sorry, Senator Dibble, did you?
I just wanted to ask Mr. Kudrowski's opinion on – so we have – we're carrying $700 million, these tobacco bonds. Those were sold to pay for ongoing responsibilities, the amount of one-time dollars owed. Now we're going to pay those bonds off over the course of, I think, 20 years. I think those are 20-year bonds. Should we pay those off if we can? Is it just a bad idea to carry those for the full 20 years?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, there's any number of options that you can use the $825 million for. In fact, Recommendation 6 of the Minnesota Budget Trend Study Commission report indicated that one-time revenues, and that's what the surplus is in a sense it's one-time revenues because you don't have a guarantee that it's going to occur, should be used strictly for building reserve, paying off shifts, capital projects, or other one-time purposes. So the tobacco bonds would be a good one-time purpose. Frankly, the tobacco bonds, in my judgment, and I've testified to this previously, is the single worst financial act that I've seen the legislature take since I got involved in public finance in the 1970s working for the Senate. So to reverse that would clearly be a positive and, again, would help with the rating agencies. In essence, you borrowed future revenues, and what you would be, in fact, doing is going back to a use of current revenues for current expenditures.
And Senator Dibble,
you raise a good point. I think we should have some discussion about that at a later date, although I believe I read that our ability to do that gets pretty complicated. But Ms. Kelly, did you want to offer a comment?
Certainly, Mr. Chair, Margaret Kelly, State Budget Director. Typically when we sell bonds, they have one call provision in which you can refund the bonds. The tobacco bonds did have one call provision, and we took advantage of that to swap out tobacco revenues as from a revenue bond to an appropriation bond. And so we no longer have a call provision on those bonds, and we will be paying them off on an annual basis. But they're no longer revenue bonds. They're now appropriation bonds.
Does that mean?
Sure. Senator Dibble.
Ms. Kelly, what is our annual debt service then, and what is our balance?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, on the tobacco appropriation bonds,
uh-huh.
I'd have to get back to you on that.
Thanks.
Hey. Senator Bonoff.
Question, Mr. Chair. I don't know who this is for, but if I go back to the slides, it lists our reserves at $1 billion, but I'm not understanding where that comes from, because if I look at the slide that talks about our budget reserve, it comes to $650 and our cash flow at $255. So if I add those two together, it doesn't come to that. So I'm wondering, what is that taking into account? Is that putting additional money into the reserves? What does that number reflect?
Mr. Scalia. Chair, Senator Bonoff, I'm sorry, which slide are you speaking to?
Well, if you look at the first slide in the deck, it says our reserves are $1 billion, a little over.
Yep.
But then when I look at the detail behind it, it says the reserves are, and that's a slide, second to the last slide, says $650 and then the cash flow $255. So if I add those two together, I don't get that billion. So I'm wondering, what's the discrepancy?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, the second to the last slide in the slide deck shows how much we have contributed to the reserves under the statute that requires us to replenish them. So prior to adding $255 to the cash flow and adding $621 to the budget reserve, we did have about $80 or $90 million remaining in our reserves. We didn't completely deplete our reserve accounts. And so I think if you were to do the difference between $255 plus $650, you'd get about $80 or $90 million, which was what our starting point for the reserve was.
So, Mr. Chair and Mr. Kudrowski, when you talk about $1 billion, you're talking about beyond the cash flow portion, you're recommending that just in the reserve account itself.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonoff, that is correct. I don't think you should consider the cash flow reserve part of the budget reserve.
Mm-hmm.
You need that for cash flow purposes, and that would really be a problem with the rating agencies if we didn't have the cash resources necessary and had to do short-term borrowing in the public markets. So the budget reserve that I was speaking of would be in addition to the $650 or another $350 million this biennium.
Mr. Chair, just so then I get the final number. So the 80 or 90 was already in the reserve amount, and so additionally to get to the billion, what would it take then?
Was that in the reserve amount or the cash flow?
That's
account?
What I want to know. So if we were to comply with Mr. Kudrowski's recommendation, what would we need to use of the 825? How much would we have to use to get to that amount sitting here today?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, the $80 or $90 million was in our cash flow account. So
we need about $350, or if you include the additional money.
Currently, currently our reserves are at $661 million.
So you need $339 million
to get to $1 billion reserve.
And Mr. Chair, by statute, I thought that our reserves, we needed them to be over 700. Is that not correct?
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Nauman?
Mr. Chair, the statute that the commissioner spoke to, 16A-152, sets a limit for the purposes of allocating any perceived any forecast that is projected into the future, and that limit is 653. Mm. Then we begin by hitting 350 on the cash flow account. Then you count how much is the reserve, and it has to be 653, and we exceed that. Then if the schools are calculated at all the – we're not shifting the schools, and under this forecast, the $15 million to the state airports fund is transferred. Once you've satisfied all of those, you begin calculating a positive balance. There isn't a statutory requirement for a specific reserve. It just is – has to be 653 in order to generate a essentially a surplus that the legislature could allocate for other purposes.
Thank you.
All right. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kudrowski, in regards to the comments Senator Stump made in terms of some of the shifts that have gone on in the past, you know, you used a couple examples of the school districts and the state employees. You know, from your perspective, when we have the economy slowing down and less revenue coming in, you know, clearly that's caused by people spending less money because we're not collecting the sales tax, and they're not earning as much because they're not getting the income tax. You know, what would your suggestion or your solution in order to, you know, allow the state employees and the school districts to participate in that slowdown? Is it just to wait to the next budget and then reduce those budgets in the next biennium, or what would you suggest?
Mr. Kudrowski.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Peterson, you have to balance the budget, and you have to do it such that the current biennium is balanced as well as the next biennium, in my judgment. And to do that, you have the choice of increasing revenues and decreasing expenditures. And some combination of that is what should be done. I've consistently personally recommended that it be a combination of some revenue increase and some expenditure reduction when we face budget deficits at the state. I think it's unfortunate to try to do it all through expenditure reductions because the expenditure reductions are so significant and it's disruptive. If you're trying to run a government in the state of Minnesota, be it a city government, a school district, a county, or even a state agency, having this yo-yo effect of resources is very difficult to manage successfully. And I think we don't really consider that when we put all of a deficit on the cut side of expenditures. I think we need to look at both revenues and expenditures.
Okay. Yeah. Mr. Chair, Mr. Kudrowski, you know, I think that is sound, and I think in a perfect world, most people would like that. You know, but the reality, you know, what our economy was going through, you know, we had employers, you know, that would lost 30% of their revenue in 12-month period in 2009 and 2010, and I'm not sure it's reasonable that the residents and our constituents would expect our government to not have to make those similar types of cuts and reductions that they're having to do, you know, particularly when they're the ones that are expected to pay the bill. And so I think you understand the challenge of having a revenue account or a reserve account of that size because, you know, I think our residents just think that there's probably better uses for those dollars in the private sector economy rather than waiting to just level out a downturn in the economy for our state budget and for our state government.
Mr. Chairman, again, Senator Peterson, you and I may disagree. I think it's poor public policy to have that yo-yo effect occurring. I spent 17 years in the private sector working for Norwest and Wells Fargo, and I had a bottom line that I had to manage to, and we went through some difficult years and we went through some good years, and I tried to make sure that I had enough in reserve such that I didn't have to lay off people and or cut salaries or freeze salaries in the bad times because it's a bad business practice. I think if a group of businessmen were brought here to look at the state situation, I think that they would agree that a budget reserve makes a lot of sense for the state's financial situation.
Mr. Chair.
Sir Peterson.
Yeah, and I think the situation we were dealing with in 2009, as we mentioned, was a one in well, very rare events, because I know for a fact Wells Fargo, for example, was sending letters to their customers with a 30-day notice, you know, canceling their credit lines, demanding payment for their long-term debt to private businesses. And that's what the reality of what our economy was going through at that time.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Peterson, again, I agree with you that expenditure reductions would be needed as part of a response to a severe recession.
Thank you.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, the rating agencies are more subtle than you would suggest. They don't have clear guidelines. They talk about general things that are important, the management of state government, the political environment, the size of the reserve, staying out of short-term borrowing. All of those things are part of the decision-making of the credit rating agency, but there isn't clear guidelines that you can simply check them off and say, okay, now we're at AAA. It's far more subtle than that. And frankly, the latest issue that's really the rating agencies are focusing on is pension liabilities. The city of Minneapolis lost its AAA credit rating, not because it didn't have adequate budget reserves, but in fact because of the perceived pension liability, even though now the city of Minneapolis is part of the state pension system.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Kudrowski. And just a comment, obviously, as folks can tell, we'll have some discussion on the budget reserve. It'll be a determination by this committee as to, you know, the budget surplus monies are within the Finance Committee, obviously for determination by the full Senate, but start from within this committee. And certainly there's some interest on the part of some members of the Senate, including myself, Senator Nino, obviously, from your comments. I'm not sure about placing the entirety of $825 million into the budget reserve, but I think some of us would like to see some of that reserve augmented. But that would be a subject for a much longer discussion on at a different time. We want to spend a few minutes with Ms. Weber to talk about the budget system update. So, Senator Dibble?
Sure. I just wanted to go back to the tobacco bonds for 1 second just to get some information.
Okay, sure.
Thank you. Did we, Ms. Kelly, did we find out? I think Mr. Nauman has the answer to my question.
Mr. Chairman, members, Senator Dibble asked how much in debt service we were appropriating out of the general fund to support the state appropriation refunding bonds. I've had a chance to visit with the department about that. In fiscal 14 and 15, as a biennium, we're anticipating $113.9 million of appropriation to support the tobacco refunding bonds. It escalates to about $114.2 million in the tails, and I believe, Ms. Kelly, maybe a little bit higher after that, but that it levels off pretty well after that.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Dibble.
So I just want to know for my own purposes when and how the decision was made to convert those tobacco bonds to revenue bonds, whether I participated in that decision somehow with my vote. Because, Mr. Chair, I'm annoyed to learn today that we're stuck paying that $115 million per biennium until those bonds are paid off. And then the second part of my question is, are those tobacco revenues then returned to their original purpose, to the Department of Health for public health purposes, or not?
So, Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, I can speak to the first part of that question. The original law provided that authority to make that conversion.
So, Mr. Chair, then the decision actually to do that was done by the department.
after the report.
Ms. Kelly?
So, Mr. Chair, there was I may need to defer to counsel on this, but there, the original law had a provision that sent the that asked for the Supreme Court to do a review on the appropriateness of using this funding mechanism for this purpose. It was, and once the Supreme Court spoke to that point, then the department took the action to convert the bonds to the tobacco refunding bonds. So it was in the original law as passed.
Right. Okay, I think that's clear. I'm not going to delve more into that. So the tobacco revenues, what happens to those now? What, they come to the state? Where do they get deposited, and how are they used?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, yes, the tobacco revenues are deposited in the general fund as a non-dedicated revenue.
Effectively, Mr. Chair, Mr. Nauman, we're using those monies to pay off the debt. It's just fungible money going into the general fund.
Right.
And
okay.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, I'll just add that the transaction to refund from revenue bonds to appropriation bonds saved the state about $80 million over the life of those bonds.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, $80 million out of, I don't know what the entire debt service is going to be at the end of the day, 700 plus interest.
Yeah, I don't know.
not so great. So.
You have a quick question, sir?
Quick comment. To Senator Dibble, your question about where is that money going? At the time, I served in the HHS committee and was on conference committees and all of that, and that money was used in significant portion. I'm sure you're familiar with the term bending the cost curve. To bend the curve on the HHS spending projections, which effectively saved the state about $1 billion per biennium. But that savings was not dedicated in any fashion. That essentially gave us an extra $1 billion per budget in the general fund and is, as you said, fungible and goes wherever.
Thank you. Ms. Weber.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you. My name is Michelle Weber, and I'm the Budget Operations Director in the Budget Division at Minnesota Management and Budget. In your packets, you do have a copy of a slide deck presentation materials. There are two slides per page, and in the top right-hand corner of the slides, it indicates that it's for the budget systems update. In the 2013 legislative session, we received an appropriation of $4.5 million for the development of three of the technical systems that we use in the budget division. The systems that I'm going to talk about today, specifically the budget system, is different than the state accounting system that's used to manage the daily transactions that occur, and that's SWIFT. So these systems are different than SWIFT. Of the money that was appropriated, $2.1 million was dedicated to complete the development of the budget planning and analysis system. An additional $1 million was provided to replace the fiscal note tracking system that we use, and $1.4 million was dedicated for the capital budget system. The oversight structure that we've used for this system's development, we've done an intentional engagement of stakeholders, both our system users at the agency as well as our legislative users, primarily fiscal analysts. At the bottom of our oversight structure, you'll see that we have day-to-day management and project teams. I do have Christy Swanson here, who is the project manager for the budget planning and analysis system, and Lisa Dereme is in the audience, and she is also the project manager for the fiscal note tracking system. Those two systems are currently under development. Our capital budget system replacement will start the process in January. The project teams involve fiscal analysts, as I mentioned, agency staff, and Minnesota Management and Budget subject matter experts. The project teams are involved in determining what the requirements, how the systems are going to be designed, and they'll also be engaged in doing testing on the system. And then we have a steering committee that meets monthly, and the steering committee receives project updates, oversees risks and mitigation strategies associated with the projects, as well as looks at how are the dollars being utilized to support the development of these three systems. And on that steering committee, we have Mr. Nauman as well as Bill Marks from the House, and agency representation as well. And then our final decision-making body is the Executive Committee, which meets quarterly, and that includes the state CIO as well as the MMB Commissioner. We've done a series of things to engage stakeholders. I've talked about their involvement in the project teams as well as the steering committee. We are also issuing monthly newsletters, and we'd be happy to add members of this committee to that mailing list if you're interested in receiving those monthly updates on all three of the systems. We conducted a stakeholder event this Monday where we invited all of our system users. So those are people who have access to our systems. And we provided an update on the budget planning analysis system as well as showed them what the new fiscal note system is going to look like when they log into the system. So I'm going to start with an update specifically about the budget planning and analysis system, and then I'll go into an update on the fiscal note system. As I mentioned, those are the two systems that we're actively in the development of. The budget planning and analysis system was designed to be developed under three phases. The first phase of that was to utilize the system for the submission of the 14-15 biennial budget to the legislature. That system went live in August of 2012, and with the development of Phase 1, we streamlined two separate technical systems that were utilized at Minnesota Management and Budget for the budget development. One was a system that's used by agencies and fiscal analysts, and then the other was an internal system that is utilized to support the decision-making process with the governor. The system is an off-the-shelf product. It's an Oracle Hyperion planning and budgeting system that we have customized for use at the state. After the first phase implementation, we worked with the Management Analysis Division at Minnesota Management and Budget to develop a survey of our system users and to conduct focus groups with our target audience that is using the system to identify what improvements we should make to the system prior to developing any further capacity in the system. And as a result of that stakeholder engagement, we learned that we need to improve reporting. That was one of the number one things that was reported, that users need easier reporting as well as increased reporting capabilities. And so we've done things with the system to increase the system's performance so that it can pull back data under quicker circumstances. We've also upgraded the system to be compatible with Internet Explorer 9. When we first released it, it was only compatible with Internet Explorer 8. And we've also redesigned the change application, which is the application that's used by Minnesota Management and Budget with the governor's office to support the decision-making process. As we go into utilizing the system for the next biennial budget process, we will also release some revised reporting capabilities. So we're planning to streamline the user's experience in generating reports from the system. And finally, we'll be rebuilding our transfer application, which is more of a transactional component to the budget system, and it captures both sides of the transfer, where dollars are coming from and where they're going to. Future development, then, for the budget planning and analysis system is under it's on page 4 of your handout, and it talks about Phase 2 and Phase 3. And so we are actually building out the Phase 2 and Phase 3 functionality at the same time. When each of the functionalities will be released will be as they become available. So there's not a specific go-live date where all of the functionality will be released at one time. We are currently using the system for the purposes of the supplemental budget that will be submitted to the legislature this upcoming session. And we are planning that at the end of this session, we'll be able to publish information from the system on the enacted budget. Then for the 16-17 biennial budget development, the process for that starts next summer. We will have functionality in the system that will help agencies to develop their compensation budgets related to their employees, and they'll be able to do different modeling and project out for both 16 and 17 as well as the 18 and 19 biennium. We will also utilize this system for the submission of the departmental earnings report, which will be due in January of 2015 to the legislature. And at the conclusion of the 2015 legislative session, our plan is to have functionality in the budget system to load the enacted budget information back into our accounting system, from which then agencies develop their annual budgets and start to perform transactions against the budget that is enacted for them. And then a final functionality that we will have available will be the ability to report from the system monthly revenue estimates compared to what we're actually collecting in terms of revenues. So that will conclude then what we have planned in terms of full system functionality with BPAS. On the fiscal note tracking system, we kicked off that project in July after receiving the funding during this last session, and we've completed the design and requirements for that project, and the build is currently underway. As I mentioned, we were able to display to stakeholders earlier this week what will it look like when they log into the system, and so those screens and so forth are being developed right now. Our plan is to go live with that new system for the 2015 legislative session.
And Ms. Weber, on that, mm-hmm. You've got a sample attached to.
Yes. Yeah.
Are we going to see the same kind of information, or will there be less information?
So, Mr. Chair and members, what Senator Cohen is referring to is attached to the presentation materials are two samples that our project team is currently considering to what the fiscal note document would look like from the system. We do have the option with the development of the new system. One of the things that we are looking at is what should the system produce? Should it produce the fiscal note document in the format that has traditionally been provided, or should the presentation be modified and more useful? And in talking with stakeholders, we heard that summary information and answering questions very easily in an understandable way is an important thing to do with the fiscal note document. And so we're currently now looking at two different options for how the fiscal note document would be presented. And one of the things that we'd like to do is hear from all of you about these options we're considering, because you are the primary audience that utilizes this tool. There is an option A, which is attached to your document, and an option B. There are two different versions for each of the options. For option A, we've shown you what a consolidated fiscal note might look like, and that is a fiscal note that includes more than one agency in the fiscal note document. And then we also have a option A, which is a single agency fiscal note that is being completed. In option A, there is a summary table that would be on the front page of the fiscal note document that would show what the costs or savings are to the state by fund. And then also it would show you the full-time equivalent impact of the proposed legislation. On page 2 of the document, it would then show you the detail of, for that net cost or savings, what is comprised with respect to expenditures, and then what is the revenue impact? And this is still containing the same information that you've received on previously in fiscal notes. It's in a reformatted way. Option B, then, of the fiscal note provides both that summary information at the top, which is highlighted by a box around it, and it's got the shaded area that says fiscal impact by fund. But then it also shows you on that first page what's the breakout of that net cost or savings with respect to expenditures and the revenue impact.
Well, Ms. Weber, you suggested, since we're, I think, kind of the stakeholders in this thing, my strong position would be the more information, the better. The more complex the fiscal note is, the better. And I guess maybe at this point I'm about ready to surrender, but I've had this ongoing debate with every Department of Finance. I think Senator Stumpf and I are the senior finance chairman around this place. And this isn't related just to the fiscal note process, but we keep on seeing diminishing information in the budget pages generally. And if I go back to when I was first a finance chairman, and at that time State Department's was about 2.5, 3 times what it is now, I had budget books that had just a wealth of information in terms of where the budget had been, you know, where the proposed budget was, and so on. And I've had this debate with I don't know how many finance commissioners now about, and it doesn't matter which party and which commissioner, about the information we get. But particularly where we're dealing with legislation that's going to significantly impact the budget where we're not quite sure, you know, it's not in the context of the budget pages, but particularly with the fiscal note process, I would strongly argue for the more information, the better. Not so much a streamlined fiscal note process.
And Senator Cohen, members, we are also, in addition to the fiscal note document, to respond to the fiscal pages and the budget documents, we're also looking at and mapping out, with respect to feedback we got during the last session, what would the fiscal pages look like for the 16-17 budget, and we will bring them to you for consideration as well.
Okay.
Prior to
I'd be delighted if you found the budget books from about 20 years ago and compared them to that.
There is a copy of a budget book from, I believe, the Pertich administration that's been given to me and is on my desk. So we're looking at both historical information, so information on the 12, 13, 14, 15 biennium, as well as what's the projected spending.
I'd be satisfied with the first term of the Carlson administration. Sarah Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I was listening to the presentation, I was thinking exactly the same thing you were. The more information, the better. And I would say that from a standpoint of a senator who has not been on the Finance Committee for a long time, the information that is contained in the fiscal note is really important as we are listening to specific bills. Point out that there is a statute in Minnesota that requires, at least to the extent possible, the information that is to be included in the fiscal notes, and I certainly would not want to back away from those required contents. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Dibble?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to pile on here.
Okay.
I don't think you have to go back as far as, I mean, you know, I've been around since the Ventura early Palenty days. And actually, there's a lot of good information in those budget books. I mean, this last round was exceedingly frustrating. There just wasn't the kind of information I needed as a finance chair. And we had to ask a lot of questions to get clarity about where we'd been and what was currently in front of us. Then I have a question, Mr. Chair, about the fiscal notes. Maybe I missed it, and I apologize if I did. Is policy analysis narrative going to be included as well?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, yes, and we are not changing the format of the – we're not proposing a change to the format of that at all. And I should state that we're not proposing to change the content of what information or what data is provided in the fiscal note. We're proposing that we've gotten some feedback from fiscal analyst agencies as well as budget division, executive budget officers about the way in which the organization of the data might be more easily understandable. And so that's what we've done here is mocked up a proposal for organizing the information in this way and to and are interested in hearing back from all of you because we recognize that changing a format of what people have traditionally been used to looking at is really challenging. We want to make sure that we're providing the information that's needed, that it's in an understandable format.
Mr. Nauman, and then Senator Anderson.
So, Mr. Chair and members, maybe to facilitate this as budget chairs and as ranking members and simply members on divisions, it would be helpful if you had comments to bring them to fiscal staff, any of the fiscal staff. I can tell you that Mr. Albrecht and Mr. Turner are actively sitting on the committees, and I'm on the steering committee that's doing this work, so I would very much relish your opinions. It was at my encouragement that this be added to the agenda here, because I wanted it to be in front of you. They've already asked Mr. Marks and myself which one of these two we preferred. I can make arguments on both sides. I think in both cases, the information that you're looking for is all there. It's a question of organization, how simple that first page is versus how complex it is. And where I understand this issue hat as well as I don't understand this issue hat, as you're thinking through it, that would be helpful. Because sometimes you're looking at a bill, members, frankly, that is completely foreign to you, and you want a simple, streamlined, what's the bottom line number? And in that case, option A may be more favorable to you, and then flip to page two and get more detail. Or if you really understand the issue, maybe you'd prefer option B and to just dive right into all the detail. And I'd be happy to walk through some of the thinking on that on an individual basis if you'd like. But I ask you to wear two different hats. There's clearly more than one legislative audience at any one point when you're looking at a fiscal note. If it's your bill, you know it intimately, and it's real clear to you, and you want the detail quickly. But sometimes if you're just observing another member's bill, maybe you want a simple overview first. So I'm being somewhat redundant here, but I ask you to think about it, and I'm sincerely asking you to give us feedback on your thoughts.
Senator Anderson.
Chairman, I would recommend option P. Option P is so much simpler, and it's just mentioned that it's not
I was referring to the when I was first chairman, it was the Carlson administration. Okay. I think Ms. Weber mentioned she's got one of the Perpich books. And Senator Anderson, I just asked Mr. Nauman if we can find a couple of those older books and take a look at them. Senator Dibble?
Thanks. Just a quick question / comment. Mr. Nauman, I assume you're involving your fiscal analyst staff.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, absolutely. Okay. In terms of efficiency, we've put Mr. Turner and Mr. Albrecht on the actual committee, and they're doing the day-to-day, mm-hmm. frankly, some of the mundane process that goes on behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. But then all of us, we've already had at least one fiscal staff meeting, and I'm giving them examples as we go to wrestle with some of these choices. So, yes, all the fiscal staff are involved.
Great, Mr. Chair. Have you been reaching out to our committee administrators?
Mr. Chair, I have not at this point, although I think that's an excellent idea, and we should probably, once we get a little bit closer to locking down on getting some ideas, and I'm open to any of your suggestions on how we handle it internal to the Senate.
Yeah. And then, Mr. Nauman, are you involved in the development of the budget materials, the budget books? Are you also have a role in that project?
Mr. Chair, or is it Mr. Chair now? Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble. Yes, there's a process that MMB has put together. That's why Ms. Weber is here briefing us on that. It includes fiscal staff.
All right.
That's an evolutionary process as well.
Okay. Well, if I recall,
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It was kind of midstream Pawlenty administration that suddenly information started falling out of the budget books, and then that trend has continued since that time. So we could go back to like early Pawlenty or Ventura, those budget books were pretty informative. Yeah.
So, Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble and members, just to be clear, we're really talking about kind of three different things here. We're talking about the budget system. Mm-hmm. That's the electronic system that fiscal staff and agency staff use for the purposes of building the budget. Mm-hmm. There's the budget document, and I think that's where many of your comments are addressed mm-hmm. to, and I guess the concern would be that there's less information in there than has been in the past. And then the fiscal notes, the report. Mm-hmm. And there's actually an electronic system behind that as well. Mm-hmm. And all of that is up for discussion here.
Well, the budget system, I'm agnostic on. If it works for you and the agencies and building the budget and managing the budget, I can deal with it.
So, Mr. Chair and members, we especially want your thoughts at this stage. I think Ms. Weber would probably concur more than even I would on what you'd like to see in the fiscal notes as the primary consumers of the fiscal notes for the purposes of making your decisions.
Yeah. All right. Thank you.
Senator Peterson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Weber, I just had a quick question relating specifically to the fiscal note policy manual. I know our office has referred to that on a fairly regular basis throughout various sessions at this point. And the date on the last one I know was December of 2012 in terms of it being updated. And I realize you may be not prepared to answer this question, but if you are, great. If not, I'll just contact you at a later time. But has that been updated for 2013? And if it is there any changes that you know of to that manual?
Ms. Weber.
Mr. Chair, Senator Peterson, it has not yet been updated for 2013. This is about the time when we traditionally update that prior to the next session starting up. I'm not aware of any major updates that we would need to make to that manual. When we last updated it in 2012, we had the passage of private fiscal notes had occurred in the previous session, so that was a major change. We incorporated policy around that during that time, but I'm not aware of, there haven't been any legislative changes or anything that would result in significant changes to the policy manual.
So, Mr. Chair, Ms. Weber, so if there is changes, is that something you'd send out to each elected office, or how would those get the information on that get disseminated?
Mr. Chair and Senator Peterson, what we traditionally do is send out notification to all of our system users. So all of the fiscal analysts in the Senate would receive notification that the manual has been updated. And we also send out notification that we're providing training on the system. As I mentioned at the beginning of my presentation, we are expanding our stakeholder audience because we are recognizing that legislators, while not using the technical systems that accommodate these processes, are the consumers of the information. And so what we can do is add all of you to our stakeholder listserv so that you would receive notification.
Thank you. I guess I would appreciate, Mr. Chair, knowing and any changes to that policy manual, because I think we have had to refer to that from time to time. So,
okay. Any further questions or comments from members of the committee? Ms. Weber, have you completed your presentation?
Mr. Chair, I have not, but I can do so very quickly. if you look at page 5 of the presentation material, so just to let you know with respect to the fiscal note system, we are essentially rebuilding the system functionality that exists in our current system, and we're adding some enhancements so that staff will be able to export data from the system in Excel for the purposes of spreadsheets and so forth. We also will be creating security in the system to accommodate the private fiscal notes, which I previously mentioned. Currently, we handle those outside of our system because we don't have the technical security capabilities to have the data only be viewable to those directly involved in the development of those types of notes. With the capital budget system, I mentioned at the beginning that has not yet currently started. So we are utilizing our current capital budget system for the capital budget that will be submitted to you next January. And the new system will be developed in the same technology that we've developed the budget system in. It will be web-based, and it will include the capacity for local units of government to submit their requests as well. Currently, they submit them via email documents to the department. Our plan is to go live with that system in May of 2015. And so far, all of our projects are on time, and we are on budget with them. We've developed risk management plans, and we have a well-defined scope and requirements for both the budget system and the fiscal note tracking system. Some of the risks that we're paying attention to are that we've had some delays in hiring staff, particularly IT staff, and we're having challenges with finding qualified IT staff to work on the projects. We also, with three systems we have competing priorities within the budget division with the development of these three systems. It really is a tremendous task that we're taking on, developing three systems at the same time. And then with both the budget system and the capital budget system, using an off-the-shelf software product, it does come with that the software can only accommodate certain things. And so in certain cases, we have to look at our business processes and make changes because it would be pushing the technology too far to try and get it to accommodate everything that we've done in previous systems. And the last slide of my presentation materials has the contact information for any of us that are working on the project if you have any questions.
Are there any further questions from the committee or comments? Senator Anderson.
Ms. Weber, you said hiring, you're looking for more qualified people. How many, you say, number of ballpark, how many people do I need
up? Ms. Weber.
So, Mr. Chair and Senator, we currently have three open positions, and they are actually Minute staff, IT staff, that we're working in partnership with Minute to develop these systems. And so right now there are three positions that are open that just were posted recently, and we're only seeing like 3 to 5 resumes for those positions. And in many cases, the resumes don't have the qualifications or experience with the type of technology we're developing these systems in.
Ms. Weber, to what do you attribute the only few resumes you're receiving? Why so few?
In talking with Minute, they have indicated that the unemployment rate in the metro area, in the IT field, is at nearly zero. And so we have challenges in competing with salary as well as just available resources in the metro area.
Any other questions or comments? I was going to make this comment when the chair was in the chair, but I just wanted to augment his views that we ought to make a substantial addition to the reserve on the budget when we get down the road on this thing. And to that end, as the chair, I will entertain any motion to designate all of the budget surplus to the reserve. I'm just kidding. There appears to be no further business to come before the Finance Committee. We are adjourned.
You too, sir.